Well, in that case, we will just move directly on to item six. And welcome back, Mr. Graff.
Good to be back. Chair Kelly, members of the board, State Forester Hirsch, for the record, my name is Doug Graff. I serve as Chief of Fire Protection for the Department of Forestry. I'm joined by Deputy Chief Ron Graham Operations, who will provide us a fire briefing. We'll walk back to the beginning of fire season, looking at weather conditions that got us to this time, and then the significant fires early on the fire season. So not just a current status. We'll close, obviously, with that, as it's critically important with all the engagement going on today. And I'll interject along the way to add some thoughts as we get into specific fires. With that, Ron.
Right, thank you, Doug. Good afternoon, Chair Kelly, members of the board, and State Forester Hirsch. First, I'd like to say it's a pleasure to be sitting here in person and seeing you all for the first time for many of you, presented before virtually, but it's kind of nice to be back in the room and see you all. So looking forward to that, and we'll be back in September. I can say that with assurance. Don't know what the extent of the report will be then, but we'll be back, right? So getting into the fire season and what got us to where we are. The state is currently in extreme drought in 43% of the state, 12% in exceptional drought. So the very darkest brownish rust through the center of the state there is the exceptional. The next darkest red color is extreme drought. And you can see the remainder of the state is still in severe drought, with a few areas still along the coastline hanging into that moderate drought. But as you're very well aware of, we've had no precipitation for quite some time with nothing measurable in sight. So that's only going to continue to strengthen the drought conditions across the state. 19 counties have declared drought. The coastal counties, Coos, Lane, Lincoln, they are all at risk and have requested but have not been declared in drought status as of this time. So we had another significant thing happen to us along with the drought, and that was the event called the heat dome, when we had the record high temperatures back at the end of June. And if I'm tracking correctly, we fell just short of being the hottest June ever on record. We were the second driest spring on record since 1895. And this impacted stream flows, soil moisture, all of that stuff. And these high record temperatures had an adverse effect on, you know, fire occurrence and firefighting operations as well. So you take the drought, couple it with the extreme heat dome that we had, and many of our fuels became extremely dry. Fuel temperatures had risen to extreme lengths in our 1,000-hour fuels, so the big fuels on the ground, the bigger logs, that kind of stuff. Dead fuels have now dropped into single-digit levels. And when Southwest Oregon typically sees 9% dead fuel moisture in their 1,000-hour fuels, they know they're going to get large fire growth. That's one of the indicators that throughout time they've tracked, and it indicates problematic fire behavior for them. So again, when we look at this, couple it with the drought, it impacted our snowmelt, it impacted live fuels green up. Fuels greened up in some places barely, others they greened up quickly and quickly cured. And the result of that really brings in a combination of the heat, the dryness, and then enters live fuel into the equation for us as well. So typically we track our dead fuel moistures because those are readily combustible and available. But as our live fuel moistures, so think of green live trees, as those drop to very critically low levels, then they too become readily ignitable and consumable by fire. And that'll lead to some of the other problems we talk about throughout the presentation here. And that's what's happening to us currently. We've had very little relief from the heat, of course, extreme low relative humidities. We've had some windy days. Wind hasn't been an extreme factor, thankfully, for us. And then lightning, we've had some lightning as well. But again, not the driving factor this summer. This summer, the driving factor is drought and fuels. And that's that'll be talked about here a little bit more.
Ron, I might emphasize the point on the wind is referencing it's not the Labor Day wind event that we experienced last year. It's a cumulative effect of drying that's making available fuels ready. If we do have a trigger point, such as an alignment of forces that we experienced on September 7, 2020, then we're even in a more problematic situation given the conditions that were available. So those trigger points are significant wind events or significant lightning events where we have multiple ignitions. So we're always watching for those, of course, in daily weather briefings.
Thank you, Doug. For those that attend our weekly fire briefings, hopefully you become a little bit more familiar with our energy release components. Basically speaks to what I just mentioned, you know, the fuels, the weather, all things that factor in how much fuel is available for combustion and consumption by fire. And what does that lead to as far as fire behavior and problematic fires? You can see the lines on there currently, the red line is where we're at with all of our stations, as you see depicted. That gray line to the top, that's the historic high. So we're tracking well above that in a lot of places. And then you can see at the very bottom, historic low and the averages. When we reach these 90th, 100th percentile, depicted by that orange line going across horizontally, that's where we hit the extreme threshold. And you can see we're well above that. In these three stations and most of our stations. This is just an example of what we're dealing with between Northeast Oregon, Prineville Sisters, and down in Klamath Lakeview area, which is where we had the bulk of the fire activity. And if you remember back to that drought picture, kind of that center of the state area from south to north is really where we're seeing that impact. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see our ODF significant fire potential. One of the things that is in our equation for determining significant fire that's a bit different from the national system is we take into account loss. So we look at costly fires that can occur on the landscape and the cost of those and factor that in. And you can see by the map, the red areas are those in extreme, the yellow are high, and the blue is in moderate. And don't be fooled by moderate on the coast range. Moderate on the coast range that's building and drying out is problematic. So when we look at this, we know the whole state is in problematic conditions. As Doug mentioned, should we get a significant wind event or lightning event or any other kind of ignitions? Looking at the weather outlooks, this is the three-month outlook that we see. And, you know, this is looking ahead for us through August, September, October. So looking ahead and then being we're in mid-July, you can see still much of the state is in that little bit darker shaded kind of orange color with the exception of maybe the northwest down to the coastal range, southern third or third of the state that's not. Both these indicators still are indicating above normal potential for temperatures to be above average. Doesn't say they're going to be above average, doesn't say how much above average. The darker the color, the stronger the probability that we will continue to see above average temperatures. So that outlook doesn't look good, but it's not surprising. We've been hearing that and expecting that all season long. Correspondingly, precipitation looks like for much of the state, kind of the eastern half of the state, let's call it, with that diagonal line in below normal chances of precipitation. We're in our driest months of the year. Again, that's not a surprise. It doesn't necessarily factor into what thunderstorms may or may not produce. This is just on the models of typical monthly rainfall that we see. So again, no surprise to us. We knew we weren't going to see an extremely wet spring and summer. Most of the outlooks as we've gone along have been very consistent with this. The updated significant fire potential, so these are the national products that are put out by the National Predictive Services branch of the National Interagency Fire Center, currently shows the entire state in that highest above normal potential for significant fires. And we've seen this play out. You can see the areas that are still depicted all the way over to Minnesota, and Minnesota is still experiencing significant fire activity, and this is late for them. Typically, Minnesota sees their green up in early to mid-June, and then they're able to support national firefighting efforts in the West. However, their resources are still committed dealing with their own incidents because of the weather factors that they've been seeing as well. The only place that's really seen some relief is down in the Southwest, where the monsoonal moisture actually did produce quite a bit of moisture and some flooding all the way up into Colorado even. Unfortunately, with the high pressure domes and the heat domes we've had, that moisture just did not make it into our country at all. Same thing for August, no relief. The only difference really is the Olympic Peninsula up there kind of drops back out of the high potential for Washington, but the whole state of Oregon stays in there. Pretty much for the West, no significant change. This will impact and is impacting our resource availability right now. The geographic areas of the Northern Rockies, the Rocky Mountain area, the Great Basin, the two geographic areas of Colorado, it's split north and south, and of course the Northwest region where we are with Washington and Oregon, continue to remain above potential for August. Typically, we would think July really kicks off the main intensity of our fire season all through August. We know they're starting earlier, they're starting longer. You'll hear about that here in a minute. July and August are big for us, and now September has become somewhat of a consistent month for us, seeing large fire activity, still team deployments into September. And far southeast Oregon sees a little bit of potential relief moving into September. And hopefully by the time the October outlook is released, we'll see significant change there with some potential for season wetting and ending rainfall. But the next 2 months, at least the rest of July here, August and September, look to be pretty consistent for us. And that's what we are planning for and organizing for is no relief. This has prompted our federal partners and ourselves to issue a fuels and fire behavior advisory for the area. These go out to firefighters, not only in our area, but all those firefighters that might be coming in from eastern areas and southern areas who maybe aren't as in tune to our fuels condition. And this basically says, it's a recap of everything we just briefed you on, is that we do have potential for extreme fire behavior, primarily in that area shaded in red. We know we've got critical live and dead fuel moistures. We've got critical low RHs, extremely dry conditions, still looking at above normal temperatures in a lot of area. Extended drought, we've seen the record-breaking heat wave. All this has led to intensified fire behavior. It has produced and resulted in several costly and destructive fires across the state and across that area. And we've seen increased resistance to firefighting control efforts as a result of this as well. If anything is a little bit of good news on our 7-day significant fire potential outlook, after yesterday, so today going forward 7 days, there's no lightning in the forecast any longer for us. So that's good news. We just see elevated potential across the areas again because of the continued hot, dry conditions with no moisture in sight. A little bit of an extreme fire behavior phenomenon that was experienced recently this year, particularly on the Bootleg Fire, and this is probably a new one for some of you. When fires get this large and fuels are being consumed at this rate and so completely, fires can produce their own weather. That's not uncommon. When the convective heating allows the smoke column and heat to rise up so far in the atmosphere, it can form a pyrocumulonimbus cloud and thunderstorm. These can go up to 6 miles up in the atmosphere. That's why the smoke column can be so visible from so far away. And again, we've seen this on the Bootleg Fire, and this creates just a ton of control issues for us for firefighter safety. When these clouds eventually collapse, these columns collapse, generally they'll create downburst winds, outflow winds, multiple directions. So the whole column can collapse and it could spread wind across the whole perimeter of the fire at times. Coupled with it can produce its own lightning and thunderstorms. Tornadoes and fire whirls are not uncommon as well. So when you think about firefighter safety and we get pyrocumulonimbus clouds, and we get these ice capping clouds and then they collapse, We oftentimes have to pull firefighters back due to safety concerns. It's just too unpredictable, and fire behavior is too intense to stay engaged. Oftentimes, even in indirect line construction, where we're some distance away from the main fire's edge, because as we've seen on the bootleg fire, we've seen 70,000 acre growth in a burn period. So just far too dangerous. Fortunately, that's not something we've seen on every fire. But every fire we have right now is not over 300,000 acres either. So, but the bootleg fire will continue to have this potential. One other thing we've seen as a culmination of all of these factors is the 2020 September fires continue to linger on the landscape. So we've had issues throughout the year with rekindles and reignitions and holdovers in those perimeters from the 2020 Labor Day fires. And just yesterday, Douglas Forest Protective Association had to go and take some action on a rekindle on the Archie Creek fire. So that's another indicator of just how dry it is. We didn't have the greatest recovery this winter. So a lot of these fires, they're not completely out. It's not physically possible to mop up every acre of ground on fires that are 150,000 plus acres. And a lot of these fuels are sheltered, and that heat remains in them until they get to that point where they're so dried out and they get a little bit of wind and temperature on them and they take back off again. So we've been dealing with that. Our federal partners have been dealing with that, and we continue. And we tried to educate the public, because obviously the public is concerned, as are we. And if you think about those people that were displaced and evacuated and lost their homes on those fires, when they start seeing smoke in the air that close to them again, obviously, and with good reason, they're nervous. But we've taken a lot of measure to communicate what our efforts are, that this, unfortunately, in these situations, isn't abnormal. It's oftentimes normal to see these kind of rekindles. What would be interesting to see is if we can go through another winter cycle and we still experience this, so multiple years, which is possible. And Alaska has experienced this same condition in the tundra, where they've had fires pop up the next year consecutively with some of their fires as well.
Ron, jump in, and I really appreciate you taking time to walking through the phenomena of fire activity. We've been getting a lot of questions relative to how does a fire get that large, and we use a lot of terms in fire, and we're trying to not do that, but resistance to control. What does that really mean? So I thought this graphic was very helpful to understand how a bootleg fire like that gets so large. Ron's presentation to date, builds upon this graphic right here. All those conditions lead to this potential on the landscape in that location, the exceptional drought conditions and resistance to control. So that's how we've ended up with such a significantly large fire. When we have these downdrafts behind the firefighters who are going direct line construction a mile or two away, dropping embers behind them, starting new spot fires behind them, that's the danger point. We always have escape routes, safety zones, lookouts to ensure firefighter safety. But the complexity of the conditions on the landscape have led to such, these mega fire conditions on the ground. And then relative to the rekindles, it's very consistent. We have been active on last year's fires very regularly. You mentioned yesterday, DFPA, I think they're running on another one today. In the Archie Creek fire. So very consistent, and we've been flying infrared technologies to highlight those before they step up and get out of control, specifically around those perimeters to ensure that they stay within the footprint from last year. And Ron, you just made me nervous thinking about another year of fighting 2020 fires. That hadn't crossed my mind yet.
Yeah, I apologize for that. So where we are to date, the top part of this graphic is our current 2021 year-to-date fire statistics, albeit this was a couple days ago as we put this together. So far, 50 lightning fires, and that acreage at 112,000 acres includes, for the sake of this, the bootleg fire and the ODF acres protected. Technically, that is still under investigation, but our federal partners for the sake of their statistics have said that was lightning caused. So that is why it's depicted there. Typically, lightning fires account for most of our acres burned. They're in higher country, back country, less roaded areas. They come in bursts of, you know, lightning bursts of multiple to hundreds of fires at once and give us those difficulties in finding them, reaching them, and putting them out. Typically, human caused remain our largest contributor for the number of fires. And you can see with 528, that still remains the same. 20,000 acres burned on ODF protection. We've seen 1.7 times more human fires currently and 13 times more acres burned. Where we sit at the 10-year average, we've been tracking along this season anywhere from 2 to 3 to 4 times higher on the number of fires. And that's slowing down a little bit right now because we're in the peak of our fire season. What was driving it early March, end of February, March, April, May, June, was the increased human-caused fire activity that we were dealing with. So total year-to-date between human-caused and lightning fires, normally 384 fires, so we're a little less than doubled. But the acres burned quite a difference in there. And you can see driving that right now, a lot of that is the bootleg fire itself and a couple of other large fires on ODF protection that are driving that increased number of acres. Interestingly enough, keep in mind, last year for the total for the fire season, which was largely in part influenced by those September fires, we burned 542,000 acres on ODF protection. That increased our 10-year average to 96,000 acres burned. So you can see once again, here we are in mid-July, we're already above the 10-year average for the number of acres burned. Probably by the end of it, our fires will be about consistent, 980 to 1,000 fires on ODF protected lands. That's kind of where we average every year. The only variation typically is in the number of acres burned. So walking around the fire map, again, we've got several large fires that we're still engaged in and a couple of large fires that are no longer on the landscape. And we'll highlight several fires that successful initial attack either kept them from reaching the extended attack level, needing an incident management team, or perhaps we deployed an incident management team for 3, 4, 5 to 7 days, not the 14-day assignments that we're seeing currently. So let's start with the Grandview fire, and you can see that in the pop-out on your box, kind of central Oregon there outside of Sisters. The Grandview fire is just over 6,000 acres and almost 1,500 acres of ODF protection. Currently 84% contained, and we do have ODF IMT 2 on that fire managing it, and that is Matt Howard as the IC. Of note, this is Matt's first solo fire as a fully qualified IC. Matt was our top priority trainee last year as an IC, and over our 11 deployments last year, he deployed on a good number of those. He did get fully qualified, and as things would happen, he had to take his first fire this year already as fully qualified IC and manage that one. He's done a great job so far. We had multiple structures threatened. The Grandview fire just missed the threshold to qualify for a FEMA FMAG, Fire Management Assistance Grant. And that was really due to the good work by the fire crews. They put in a lot of good effort, nighttime firefighting, really tough country. We've seen a history of fires in this area. Most of them have become FEMA eligible fires, but really, really good work, consistent work and support there that prevented that from happening.
Ron, I might emphasize FEMA eligible fire, generally speaking, requires over 100 primary residents immediately threatened by fire. There are other trigger points with structural impacts, communications, public infrastructure, but that's a general guidance.
Good. Kind of sticking up in this country, let's talk about the Brewer fire a little bit. It's not really depicted all that well on your map because it's relatively small. The Brewer fire is on the Willamette National Forest. It straddles our North and South Cascade districts. It's currently about 156 acres. We're kind of dealing with some mapping issues there. It's in some really rugged country, not too far south of Detroit, so a lot of attention there. Think back a couple of years ago to the Whitewater fire as well. Currently 12% contained, so that's good news. The Forest Service did order an incident management team Very early on, one of our interagency incident management teams, a type 2 team, which was good news to us. Our North Cascade district has been engaged supporting that incident with firefighters and overhead, and has now made two of the 10-person Coffee Creek female adults in custody firefighting crews available and deployed to the incident as well.
Ron, I might add, this is just a great example of interagency coordination and Oregonians coordination. So forest landowner equipment is deployed out to this fire. Really proud of the integration and coordination. There's heightened, obviously, awareness in this region. Really proud of this work. It remains tough country in that Santiam Canyon is why we saw those significant fires last year. But to see landowners, Forest Service, Coffee Creek, the corrections crew, you know, all pulling together in that tough country. I've been talking to the incident commander on this fire. With the heightened awareness, wanting to make sure I really understand, you know, the approach and objectives. And I'm really proud of the work they're doing out there. It's about 5 miles from ODF protected lands, but they've engaged aggressively. About 50%, over 50% of the perimeter is directly lined. It's burning up a hill and there's an indirect line where we just can't get fighters down into that ground. My highest hopes here is that we might keep that in around the 250-acre range, keep it in that footprint. But the reality, as we talk about west side heavier timber fires, those fires will still be smoldering and there's still threat and potential on anything we get on that west side. So it'll be with us for a while in terms of we're not going to turn our back on a fire like that. So great interagency coordination with federal partners and private landowners, ensuring we get the right resources as needed.
Very good. Thanks, Doug. I'm going to go to the Jack Fire next. It's outside of Glide. That's within the Douglas Forest Protective Association. It's primarily burning on Forest Service ground. There's about 80 acres of Douglas Forest Protective Association lands involved in that, 55% contained. That fire, too, very early on, agency administrators ordered an incident management team, type 2, to oversee that incident. And again, just great coordination, great recognition this season that conditions are different. What we've seen is agency administrators and fire managers ordering teams quicker, and that is the right thing to do to get that overhead in place to be able to support local units that they still have to worry about initial attack for all the new fires that pop up. And they're oftentimes taxed logistically in supporting those kind of firefighting efforts. So really good news there. We'll go over to the Game Hog Creek Fire. It's up in the northwest Oregon area. It's in Tillamook State Forest. Game Hog Creek's been burning since July 13th. It's about 182 acres. This is all ODF protection, all Tillamook State Forest. And so far, it's still listed as 0% contained. That, too, is in very rough country. We've been supporting firefighting operations with helicopters and other aircraft, trying to make sure we could slow things down, get firefighters in there safely, get water to it, and get that one taken care of and off the map, hopefully soon. There's a type 3 local incident management team out of our northwest Oregon area that's managing that fire. And then the Elbow Creek Fire up in northeast Oregon area. This one was quite an alarm to us when we saw this one start and take off. A lot of the local fire managers immediately reported this is in a bad spot and this is going to be a problem. It's on both sides of the Grand Ronde River. It was taking a pretty clear path right towards the town of Troy initially. A little bit since then, the winds have shifted and it's been burning a little bit more to the south. So that's been good news as far as the threat to structures. However, it's grown to over 17,000 acres, about 28% contained. About 13,000 of those acres are ODF protection. So that's another one of those fires along with Bootleg contributing to our acres burned for this year. We have our incident management team 3 with Link Smith, and this is Link's second or third time out already, in coordination with an OSFM, Office of State Fire Marshal's incident management team, their blue team in Joint Unified Command managing that incident. So far, they're making great progress. It's still very problematic. Again, some really rough country, and that one's going to be there for a while as well. And then I will close on the map just down with Bootleg, down in the Klamath area. The Bootleg fire started back on July 6th. This has been around for a long time. It's been the largest fire in the country since it started, basically. Currently over 388,000 acres, and it's growing rapidly. About 143,000 of that is ODF protected lands. That's a combination of private industrial lands and other small non-industrial ownerships. Currently listed at 32% contained. That's good news to see that containment grow. And we currently have one ODF Type 1 incident management team on it and an interagency Type 1 incident management team. Also, the Office of State Fire Marshal has their incident management team. So three teams, unified command. Those teams are getting closer to their 14 days already on this assignment. And they've been dealing with extreme fire behavior and everything else to date. It looks like we will be mobilizing and utilizing National Guard hand crews for that fire as we're getting very close to our drawdown for Type 2 hand crews nationally, as well as those that are under contract with us through our incident resource agreements. So typically when we get to that point, we will order National Guard hand crews. They will go to that fire, replace a number of the crews that are currently working there. We'll get those crews rested, available for reassignment. So we're looking at sometime early next week for a probable deployment of about six 20-person hand crews. So that's 125 people total, and then another 22 support personnel from the National Guard deploying there. So a little bit on just overall structure loss. We have lost some structures, unfortunately, on these fires. Bootleg, 184 structures destroyed. That's homes, outbuildings, ancillary buildings. Don't have a breakdown yet on the number of primary homes or secondary homes that was. And then on the Elbow Creek, we've had one structure destroyed as well. Over 3,500 structures threatened between those two fires. So not near the numbers of structures threatened in evacuations that we saw last year in September, but still significant impacts to the wildland-urban interface and to the public and structures lost. Without our partners from the Office of State Fire Marshal and all of the extra resources they brought in through the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, where they request direct assistance governor to governor for structural protection and firefighting resources, as well as all of our partners in our complete and coordinated system, including the National Guard, who have been engaged with aviation resources. They've also been doing traffic control, safety assistance for us on the Bootleg fire, and providing a medevac helicopter as well. We couldn't be successful without all those partners, landowners, contractors, everything that goes into our system. So now just a little step backwards in time here. Look at some of our success over the season so far. One of the big and earliest fires we saw was at the end of March, the Bull Springs fire that was outside of Bend, 211 acres. You can see it started from a prescribed burn, debris burn rekindle, prompted a lot of evacuations. Fortunately, good firefighting, aggressive, safe initial attack, multiple agencies coordinating together. And we got a little bit of a wind and weather break on that one. So we were able to end that without a team involvement, without FEMA. The Ponina fire down in Klamath was another early one in April. Again, great stop, great success managing these, keeping these from a full team deployment. But you can see the early fire behavior, prompting evacuations, extreme fire behavior on all of those. Then up in the Dalles, we've been busy up there early on, the I-84 Milepost 78 fire right along the interstate. And then two fires in the underprotected wheat countries near Dufour. The Office of State Fire Marshal was engaged heavily with teams on both those, the Rentham Market, just over 7,000 acres, and Sunset Valley, almost 1,000 acres. ODF did assist with aircraft on both those incidents. The Cutoff fire was one of our earliest team deployments. I see Joe Hessel, who's currently on Bootleg, first responded with his team to the Cutoff fire, 1,288 acres, again, down in Klamath District. We've been busy down in that country. It's extremely dry. Water sources have been an issue for us down there. Central Oregon, I already mentioned the Grandview fire. Before that was the Lewis Rock fire. Incident Commander Link Smith, you see another name with him, Tyler McCarty. Tyler has taken Matt Howard's place this year as our primary Incident Commander trainee and has deployed on 3 incidents, I believe, so far already, trying to get his task book signed and be fully qualified. They kept that fire to 368 acres and did a great job providing relief to Central Oregon District that was dealing with multiple fires at that time, all in extended attack. And again, we've talked a lot about the bootleg fire, the multiple teams, the data, and this is dated old. Of course, you've heard the updated acreage, and it continues to be the largest fire in the nation. And then Elbow Creek as well. Again, you can see plume-dominated fire activity. Again, it's not requiring wind to determine the direction and intensity and rate of spread. Topography and fuels are doing just a fine job at that. I'll turn it over to Doug after I just highlight where we are currently with about 27, almost 28 million in gross costs. This was updated last Friday. This will be updated again this Friday. Expect that number to be higher. And we're at about 16 million in our net cost after recoveries. We've had 2 FEMA fires to date. I talked about the bootleg fire. And then outside of Redmond, there was an initial attack, 2 fires that prompted evacuations around Redmond, the airport, Central Oregon Community College. The 419 fire actually also qualified as a FEMA fire. Not a lot of direct ODF involvement other than aircraft, so we'll see some recovery there. With that, I think I turn it over to you, Doug.
Thank you, Ron. There's not much for me to close out with. Very comprehensive report. I hope we got the big picture of where we're at and maybe just a few observations to close. We're too early for all of this, too early to see those costs, and that was a week ago. So I expect those to go up dramatically given the fires on the landscape. Several months left. I'm concerned about the durability of the system, safety of firefighters, the stress in the system, and then more broadly for the public at large and all Oregonians. The next slide, please, however, emphasizes hope and a vision for the future. The Governor's Wildfire Council was dedicated to this very topic. Earlier today, the board heard some of that conversation relative to really envisioning and applying the national roadmap of the cohesive strategy here in Oregon. We saw those investments in Senate Bill 762. So our job moving forward is to really see those investments come to fruition. A huge shout out for the governor's leadership and legislative leadership and all Oregonians who have been participating in setting a vision for Oregon to tend to these challenges and mitigate the catastrophic risk of wildfire, and frankly put Ron and I and our teams and all partner agencies in a better place to be positioned to deliver on what's expected of us, which is minimizing those acres, reducing costs and loss. So I'm looking forward to the mitigation work, the fire adapted communities work, as we discussed earlier. And we stand ready and focused moving into the future to close out this fire season, carry it through to the end. And a shout out, frankly, long before the close of session, the vision for the legislature and the governor's office to make investments early in January emergency board to set us up to have firefighters on sooner than normal was imperative, which is why Ron emphasized those early fire seasons in late March, April, and May, where we typically would not have had, you know, 7-day-a-week coverage for our seasonal firefighters. But this is a different year, a different time, and needs a different model. Thank you all. The last slide is absolutely just our mission is to provide for a complete and coordinated fire protection system, and we have that in Oregon. Could not be more proud of the foundation we have that begins with the landowners, forest range landowners, and all Oregonians to step up as needed. Every fire I speak with, the local landowner has a doza, is part of the engagement, is out there in the pickup trucks, opening gates, helping with strategies, getting access, showing us where the right place to catch this is, where we caught it last time. All the local information, knowledge, and engagement is something special and unique. So just a huge shout out for all those involved, agency and landowners alike. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Great report. I think we all wish it could have been shorter, not because we're impatient here, but for the obvious reasons. I'm just curious, one of the things that I've been noodling on is the fact with climate change and our current fire environment, you know, we still have this tremendous number of human-caused fires, and so I'm sort of in this place where we have to change that, and so I've been thinking about that, but, you know, at the same time, I look at your statistics there around how many acres are actually burned by those fires versus lightning caused fire. And of course it's pretty insignificant, but I'm interested in how else we should be looking at those numbers, particularly clearly there's all this incredible resources for initial attack, given the numbers of fires. I don't think acres is telling us a story in terms of resources that have to be expended, I would guess. And I'm interested if, you know, are you able to give us figures on how that breaks down in terms of resources? And I guess even further, to what degree putting out all those little human-caused fires actually interferes with your ability to stop these, and to fight the bigger fires. Anyhow, any thoughts and comments on that particular point?
Yeah, just a few reactions. We could spend a lot of time on that briefing map. It's a powerful map. We put it in there as you have time to absorb a little bit more. All the colors of those fires, blue, human caused, lightning is coded black on those. And Ron emphasized the acres burned by each of those phenomena. That's an important map because it just gives a little insight relative to the data and analytics available to us as how we strategize to mitigate risk of fire. And I just want to emphasize, we use all that information. We know that 64% of our fires fall within what is defined currently as our wildland-urban interface. We know we're redefining and we'll calculate that differently in the future. But for our current terms, we know where they're caused. We know how they're caused. So I've developed, and we have the legislative intent and framework to apply fire restrictions accordingly based on the data analytics and where we're seeing those fires and how they stat. So I would emphasize there's a very sophisticated approach in Oregon on the public use fire restrictions. And something I'm very proud of is in the industrial fire prevention model, where if we're going to put a combustible engine into, you know, the woods, then it comes with firefighters trained. And that's when the unique experience we have in Oregon, where every person in the woods working is a firefighter and a first responder, because those requirements of industrial fire restrictions, that's one of the connections we have. So I would say we have a robust and effective prevention and analytics, but I think there's more for us to do. We can't rest on what we have now, given the new reality. So there needs to be further thought relative to, you know, looking at catastrophic fires and how we can engage. I'll fall back to the point of lightning is the biggest driver for acres and has been for some time. Early detection and effective initial attack has always been a great formula. And the legislature in 762 invested in early detection detection to help us continue to close out the full completion of the detection camera system that we've pioneered over 20 years ago. So we're looking forward to see the closing out of that. And landowners through the Emergency Fire Cost Committee has invested in infrared technologies for the state aircraft. So we're deploying a wide range of strategies, but welcome, broader thinking relative to how other pathways available to us to reduce the fire threat. Absolutely.
Carla Chambers.
We worked with a researcher at Oregon State for years. His name was Dr. Warren Cronstedt in wheat breeding, and he said, we always learn the most from our disasters. We learned a lot about wheat cultivars in flooding years, and it's just a good time to look at the, when you've got the extremes, there's a lot to learn. I'm under of the understanding on the bootleg fire that some of that had recent mitigation work. And, you know, whether it's cultivars or looking at what was, had been thinned or, you know, increased harvest from this big a fire, what opportunities that does the department have here to really, get to the next curve on some of our learning beyond just putting the fire out? What are we thinking about there?
Thank you. The term we've recently heard and is more common is landscape scale restoration. And we continue to see an emphasis there. And the importance of the landscape scale in restoration is that we cannot continue to do small mitigation projects not connected. I think if we have landscape scale mitigation projects, i.e. this whole region was prescribed burned every 3 to 5 years before this fire, in the bootleg region, could we have, managed or resisted that catastrophic, pyrocumulus event that occurs in these conditions? So that's certainly a pathway forward, thinking how to broaden the scope of our restoration work. And then I would also simply acknowledge there are weather events that will override that work. And it's simply the reality. And September 7th is exactly that experience, where we had fire from Warm Springs down to Lyons, which is 56 air miles from the east side crest of the Cascades, down close to the valley bottom. And I just to manage some expectations relative to our effectiveness and the region, there's regional influences, east side and west side opportunities may look different relative to landscape scale restorations. And I would also, there's a lot to learn from indigenous ways of knowing and the burning cycles, prescribed burning that was done for thousands of years in this region. So welcoming, those conversations.
Brendan Cohn for the record. Just following up on Carla's question, under Senate Bill 762, we would have an improved fire risk map. We would have a designation of WUIs, and we'd have a greater capacity for prescribed fire. Is that fair?
Correct.
And then the question is, based upon what you've seen so far this fire year, and I call it a year because that's quickly getting to that point, would those actions have made a significant difference for any of these fires?
I would say absolutely. However, the science relative to what impact of climate change on the fire condition on the landscape shows an increasingly complex trend. And as I've looked at those trend lines and the maps that show increased risk from decade to decade, projected out to 2100, five years ago when I first looked at those maps, that pretty scary stuff when you start looking at those projections. It's certainly tracking on from my perspective, and it's limited understanding, you know, deep into the science around that. But as a practitioner, I would validate that that's the trend line we're heading to, more complex fire conditions. We can do work to mitigate that catastrophic risk. And there's a lot of science behind the effectiveness of treatments and the effectiveness of defensible space to give firefighters a fighting chance. We know when and where to pull out if the fire intensity is too much. By reducing those fuels in and around communities, we're going to have more space to make a stand. So I would love to be 5 years ahead of the policy work we have before us now, because I think absolutely we would be in a better place.
Thanks, Doug. That's great. Your point about defensible space, though, is critical in my mind. And that defensible space goes beyond the wildland-urban interface. It goes to wildland structure interface, does it not?
Absolutely. So
structures are fuel.
Yeah. I've often wondered about a different fuel model, and that's the urban interface, because that's where we tend to be fighting a lot more fire these days. But defensible space, we haven't really thought much about this, but it's more called the predetermined defensible space, or ridges, they're called pods, where we can predetermine where the best places to catch fires across our landscape. So the mitigation work not only is landscape treatment across the board, but where we have targeted, predetermined places to catch fires from historic data, and that's where the sophistication in firefighting is going to continue to grow. The science behind this, we've spent most of the time on weather, but there's a growing science relative to effective response and where to put our energies, and we need to be on the forefront of those conversations. And we're fortunate to have OSU close by with us on that.
Yeah. My apologies. When I think of defensible space, I think it's space around our property.
Yeah.
You're thinking of it as ridgetops and bottoms.
Sorry, I might have taken us a different route here. My apologies, but absolutely, defensible space is absolutely around our structures to give ourselves and structure firefighters a chance to defend public infrastructure or private.
Any other questions or comments? Nancy.
Good afternoon, Nancy Hirsch, Acting State Forester. You guys have heard a lot about the fire season, and I've been talking to you all day about the number of days that have gone by. The last three incident management teams for the deployments for the agency took place in a period of 10 days, almost the last 10 days. And that's the mobilization of, 40 plus people on an incident management team that come from all places of our offices here centrally and throughout all the district and unit offices. That's the complete and coordinated system. And at the same time, I'm just reinforcing that we do have people that we're holding back. We're focused on these competing priorities that are all very important. And lastly, just want to thank really everybody in the agency for that complete and coordinated effort, the training, the mentoring, the succession management that's going on from top to bottom and throughout the organization. This last week in this fire season has been very significant. And I'm glad we've had just a couple days where we weren't adding a new fire to the map. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Stay safe.
Yeah.